This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Hey, what's up, guys? We're going to welcome you to another special edition of the Mormon Expression Podcast. I'm going to be your guest host, Tom, and today's podcast, we're going to try to do something a little bit different. We're going to be talking and discussing the topic of why the church discourages discussion over its doctrine. And so we want to kind of delve into that. We want to discuss why the church exactly discourages some of the things that might be a little bit over its doctrine or a little bit more controversial. Tonight we're going to have two of our regular panelists to debate this issue, and taking the pro side, which might be a little bit fun to hear, is Niall.
This is Niall.
Welcome, Niall. And then taking the critical side of things is going to be George.
Hi, everybody.
And I'm going to be doing my best to moderate this discussion, so we're going to try to keep it a little bit structured. I'll give a little bit of time for each. Each will be given about a 5 to 10 minute introduction. Then we'll have an optional rebuttal if they want, and then some Q&A, and then some conclusion. And we'll see how this goes. We're hoping that this works fairly well. So let's turn some time over to let's begin with Niall. And we'll let him kind of give his take and his perspective in his introduction. So take it away, Niall.
Thank you, Tom. As I researched this subject, it really occurred to me that this is one of the most misunderstood aspects of the church and probably one of the most misrepresented criticisms. Essentially, this idea that doctrine is not openly discussed, that there's no honest discourse, is frankly untrue. It's a blatant misconception. This idea, this image of a static church, is not reflected in reality. Mormons do debate doctrine, and this is primarily how it progresses. There has always been an active and lively discourse within the body of the church. This is evident throughout the recorded history of this dispensation, and really all others. This is evidenced in the Book of Mormon and throughout the New Testament. The conclusions of the theories, however, theories of new doctrine, old doctrine, they must fit the evidences in the context of fulfilling the changing needs of its membership. I'm very distressed, but critics will unfairly portray an unchanging doctrine that will make it easier for them to attack an obsolete straw man. In point of fact, this is the usual method of critics that attack well-established fact. Consider the current state of creationism and intelligent design. They can't directly attack logically irrefutable evidence of evolution, so they have to create something that is false. Let me turn my attention to the body of the church. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about all the areas that doctrine is proposed, developed, and accepted or rejected. I consider this area sort of spheres of discourse. The first place where critics will assume the church should be talking about doctrine is Sunday school. Sunday school, or the church proper, is not the appropriate place to discuss these nuances of complex things. This is a place to recharge spiritual batteries, not to engage in, you know, possibly competitive discourse. Church and Sunday school should be thought of as the equivalent of high school science classes, which are really not the places to explore new technologies. where new ideas are explored is what the CES is for. Scholars at all the campuses of BYU, institutes in places of higher learning, and countless other places are set aside for discussion. There are also safe and critically controlled spaces online. Now let's take a step back. What kind of discourse is occurring in these spheres of discourse? Essentially, it's the science of theology. Theology is about taking the primary sources, and using our brains to deduce their implications. The Lord expects us to do our due diligence and work out what we can. This is done by a rigorous process based on certain guidelines. Thus, because it's mainly because humans are proposing ideas and using their own process of opinion and deduction, we are left with an imperfect science of theory, trial and error, and a process which really is nothing, which is not unlike the scientific method. Now let me explore what I'm talking about when I refer to something as evidence. Evidence is specific canonized revelations that provide the basic meat of facts. This information comes to us almost unfiltered as a primary source to the mouthpiece of the Lord. These bits and pieces of information are relatively infrequent, as the Lord understands that his children need to learn to think for themselves. Now, secondly, the theories and extrapolations that we take from this evidence are what we call doctrine. They're usually accomplished by prayer and discussion, and from the evidence, which is peer-reviewed by qualified people, in other words, ones who have access to further primary sources, you have to understand that the doctrine will occasionally have checks on people who have a greater insight to the primary sources. Since much of the doctrinal stage is based on the imperfect opinions and paradigms of human, some errors may creep in. Further revelation and peer review by the brethren is required, and effective at correction. New doctrine is only accepted after a consensus is reached and approved by the general membership. This may take some time, giving an illusion, let me stress that, an illusion of a sluggish church. This is untrue, however, as most scientists can attest. Any scientific theory must go through the rigors of a scientific vetting process, and this also takes time. Obsolete doctrine is allowed to expire, and it never needs to be directly refuted. Lacks in the priesthood, polygamy, various aspects that may seem troubling to later generations are actually perfectly attestable. The scientific method does not directly refute old theses either, but rather allows them to lose favor. Only years later can these theses seem to be strange or silly. You can see examples of this as evolution replaces creationism in the scientific discourse. The observer has the benefit of time between him and the thesis. Doctrine functions in a similar fashion. There is absolutely such a thing as an obsolete doctrine which in no way contradicts current truth. Let me talk a little bit more about the corrections to doctrine, because this is another area that critics unfairly characterize the church. The church might need to correct doctrine that does not meet this standard that I just talked about, or that has been shown to be inaccurate through further light and knowledge. So, for an example, if a theory, a thesis, is shown to be untrue and can be proved to be untrue, it has to be corrected. How is this accomplished? The church does this by gently showing the errors, encouraging further debate, and so forth. It is only in extreme cases where scholars refuse to see reason that they must be removed from the conversation. Think of it as a purely social phenomena, similar to a wayward scientist who holds a disproven theory. It is not about censorship or even as an attempt to direct the conversation, but should rather be viewed as an attempt to clarify the accuracy of available source materials. for the other theologians. You cannot let a crackpot poison the shared information of everybody trying to come to the truth. Such removals is very rare. And over the last several decades, there's been something like a dozen intellectuals who refused to see the light and refused to see that their method was flawed, and they were removed from the conversation. This, I have to note, is a better rate than most universities and other academic forums. This process, which I describe, which to sum up, the spheres of discourse, the theology, which is based on primary sources and the doctrine is extrapolated from the evidence, which allows for obsolete doctrines to expire and corrections to doctrine to proceed, has been the standard of the church for the entirety of its history. And that's the end of my introduction.
Nice. All right. Let's turn it over to George.
I am not going to do justice to the excellent apologetic method that Niall just used of dazzle them with the BS if you can't reason with their intellect. So I'm going to go a little bit more of a casual tone and not so much the rhetoric. So I'm going to do some quotes from the Gospel Essentials book. And really what I want to do is work from the chapter of honesty. And there's a few quotes in here that I really like, and I'm going to start with just a simple commandment that comes out of Exodus that says, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." That was taught at the time of the Lord gave that to the children of Israel. Christ taught it when he was on the earth in Matthew. And we learn from the Gospel Essentials manual that there are many forms of lying and untruths. I want to just read a quote that says we can intentionally deceive others by a gesture, a look, by silence, or by telling only part of the truth. Whenever we lead people in any way to believe something that is not true, we are not being honest. And I want to remind and have us think about what it means to be honest as we talk about this discussion today. And my intention is to show and to provide examples during the course of the discussion that will indicate that this comes down to a simple case of following Christ's admonition to be honest and make sure that we are not doing anything to lead the people in any way to believe something that's not true. And I want to just quickly bring up some examples of how we can know if the church is covering up or holding or withholding the full story at some point. The apostles themselves have admitted and admonished to not teach the full version of church history. We can see very many examples of this. There's a famous quote by Elder Packer. The reasoning for this is this milk before meat mentality. The diet of church history is never transitioned to meat. Niall indicated that oftentimes we have opportunities to learn meat in areas like CES and at BYU. And I can give examples of where I would dispute that concept. So members are left forever to subside on the milk of church doctrine. Church educators for seminary and institute often take it upon themselves to learn the meat, but when they attempt to share this meat with eager students, they are sometimes disciplined, threatened, and as Niall indicated earlier, they can be fired and terminated from employment with either the educational system or CES educational system. So while the upper management of the church preaches honesty, they themselves are failing to be honest themselves under the very definition of the term. Going back to the Church Gospel Principles book, there's another quote in there that says, "We can also intentionally deceive others by a gesture or a look, by silence, or only telling part of the truth." And essentially what is taught in seminary, institute, primary, Sunday school, gospel doctrine classes around the globe in all areas of the world is severely biased, watered down, and often modified version of real events. I have a quote I want to read from an ex-LDS historian, Michael Quinn. He says, "It is my conviction that God desires everyone to enjoy freedom of inquiry and expression without fear, obstruction, or intimidation. I find it one of the fundamental ironies of modern Mormonism that the general authorities who praise free agency also do their best to limit free agency's prerequisites, access to information, uninhibited inquiry, and freedom of expression." Indeed, if we look at some of the other quotes even further back in the church history, we find that many of the early church leaders actually encouraged debate with doctrines and policies that would come out. President Joseph F. Smith talked one time, and he says, "We talk of obedience, but do we require any man or woman to ignorantly obey the counsels that are given? Do the first presidency require it? No, never." Joseph Fielding Smith said, "You cannot accept the books written by the authorities of the church as standards of doctrine, only insofar that they are accord with the revealed work in the standard works. Every man who writes is responsible, not the church, for what he writes. If Joseph Fielding Smith writes something which is out of harmony with the revelations, then every member of the church is duty-bound to reject it. If he writes that which is in perfect harmony with the revealed word of the Lord, then it should be accepted." I want to just respond very quickly to something that Niall brought up about the, in the CES program and within the BYU program, and speak from terms of a self-experience in both of these areas. I have taught within the CES system for the past 5 years, and my I have one of my children is attending BYU in Provo. And I need to emphasize that in both those programs, it is a strictly a milk only. There is no opportunities ever within those programs, and we are discouraged from getting into anything that would be considered meat or deeper topics. It's light. It's the correlated material only. That's what I have to go with to start off with, and I think we can move in more into discussion mode now.
All right, very nice. I appreciate that. All right, Niall, would you like to give kind of a quick rebuttal? Or?
Yes, I think I would.
All right.
I have to ask a few clarifying questions here. You basically implied that the church does not allow for a meat approach, and that it actually openly discourages any critical look at the meat approach. However, how do you account for the vast amount of in-church material written unofficially, but still within the sphere of discourse? How do you account for that if it's being, censored?
Could you give an example or two?
Rough stone rolling.
Okay. So, excellent example, and I would tend to agree that has been a new element that has come into the church within the last 5 years that seems to have a sense of openness and seems to go the right direction. Let me give you an experience that I've had from, again, going back to just a personal anecdote. Of carrying that book with me in various church and areas of the church where I would expect it to be widely accepted. So since I've started reading that book, I generally will carry it with me on Sundays and read it during a couple of my meetings. And invariably, if people see me reading it, they look with disdain and they say, "Oh, you're reading one of those books." So the general populace, and I would say that I have only met one or two people wandering the halls and wandering around even in Temple Square that understand that Brother Bushman is a stalwart member of the church, that he has written a book that predominantly shows a good light on many of the things that are in there, and the major population seems to just say that it's potentially an anti-LDS look at Joseph Smith's life.
Follow-up question?
Sure.
Given what I've described as this giant sphere of discourse, of which Sunday school is a very tiny part, and the people you meet there are there for a very specific reason, which is not to discuss these sort of things, but to recharge their spiritual batteries. Given this, is it fair for you to impute this particular attitude you encountered to the entirety of the sphere?
Good clarifying question. There are opportunities, I believe, for the for members of the church who want to fill their vacuum of intellectual discourse and deeper doctrines. I think there are opportunities online and occasionally at some conferences such as FAIR and anything that Farms puts on that would allow them to do that. However, in the outer stakes, in any church member who is outside of the Wasatch Front, I don't believe those types of opportunities exist anywhere in the church today. There's nothing within a ward program, stake program, or regional program that would allow for face-to-face discourse to learn more than just the correlated material.
First of all, you just conceded the point that the church does not discourage or censor open intellectual debate of the doctrine. Secondly, you slightly conceded before that these areas are not the place for this intellectual debate. So why would you expect to go to the desert and expect to find water? That's not the part of the sphere where you're going to find this. Why are you expecting it to be there?
Those members of the church who are looking and exploring will be censored in their questions until they find these avenues that they can look for.
But the avenues exist?
The avenues don't exist and aren't published and aren't made available to the general public. It's only through pretty involved research to try and find out where some of these things are.
Let me finish
really quick. If a member has a question in general and they take it to, let's say, about some of the deeper doctrines, they want to know about the ins and outs of polygamy in the celestial kingdom, they want to know the details of the blacks getting the priesthood, or they want to know the details of the Book of Abraham issues. If they go to most bishops, they will not be given any type of a methodology or a means by which they can do things. They will be turned back just to the basics of please pray about this, read the Book of Mormon more, go to the temple. Most bishops are not given there's no instruction ever provided bishops to send members to places like FAIR, the FAIR Wiki, anything like that. They are told only to pray, attend the temple, and to read their scriptures. So there's no formal program to send people when they have questions to any place where they can get to theological help.
This seems to contradict the sort of narratives that I've heard of people who eventually leave the church, that the first thing that they get after the stock answers of the level is they get an article from FAIR. They get an article from Farms. They get directed to the ward sort of apologist. And then from there they spring out into the internet or further into other discussion areas of the sphere. And they're not censored for that. They're not excommunicated for that. Is this totally against what you're thinking?
If a bishop or stake president gets in touch with a member of the church who is having questions and wonders about things in church doctrine, a lot of times you are right, they will be sent an article from the Farms or from FAIR. However, a lot of times what this does in the mind of the member is adds more confusion because the apologetic techniques that are used tend to build straw mans. They tend to attack the authors of documents rather than going directly at the issues, or oftentimes they will ask the member to just believe them because they are have more expertise and more willingness to understand this than the average member, and so they should just go ahead and answer that. So the apologetics actually ends up causing a lot of damage that I don't think they intend to do, but they need to somehow, if they're going to convince more people that what they're doing is the right thing, they need to speak on terms that the general member is going to understand, which they can't. It fails. They do not have solid answers for some of these things because over time it has changed and a lot of their arguments disappear over time, and so they have to invent new ones.
All right. Let's.
I have to rebut that. Can I hear that one time?
Okay. Make one point.
Okay. The question is not how effective farms or fair is in their answers. The question is whether or not the church censors or discourages that. And it seems to me the most you're able to argue for is an inefficient crossover from the one section of the sphere to a more advanced section of the sphere. And that's a quality that's almost universally common to large organizations. So basically, you're criticizing the church for being big.
I would expect the church to not resort to big organization tactics. If there is truth and there is doctrine and there is revelation, they should not have to resort to a method that you described earlier that basically says that there's some errors that creep in. They have to go through a scientific process to prove these things out. Revelation is revelation. And revelation should not need to go through a scientific process. It should be revealed to a prophet, and then stays that way from then on. This idea of things that are untrue have been shown to be removed later on. That's not how doctrine is corrected. Things that are come from God should stay that way through millennia. And
all
Christ,
right.
Christ's word has not changed.
All right, let's move to a little bit of a Q&A. I've got a few questions that hopefully you guys can kind of give a little bit of perspective. So we've been talking about this milk versus meat issue. Niall, what do you think about that? Do you think that the coming from a pro-LDS approach, do you think that the church doesn't really talk about the meat, that it only encourages the milk, kind of like what George was talking about? Do you think that it's just a milk-only approach?
It's really a question of where within the sphere you're going to go to. If you're referring to Sunday school and a sacrament meeting, you're only going to find the milk because this is only a milk sort of area. If you're looking for the meat, you're going to have to go to places where the meat is discussed, and this would be in articles on farms and on fair and in various other discussion fora. Now, this unfortunate, taken out of context idea of holding the complex back in order to control is another unfortunate straw man, unfairly created by the critics. It's something that exists in every advanced study, and theology as an advanced study should not be expected to be exempt from this. You start with the simple basics. For example, you start with the simple basics of biology with cells. You talk about cellular walls, and then finally you move into mitochondria. And if you want to, this was what you could consider milk. You would expect to find this in, like I said before, in this high school science class section of the church's sphere.
Yeah,
again,
but
if you want to get into the ATDP or however that goes, I'm not a biologist, you would go on to the university level and learn which amino acid this represents. Same thing with mathematics. Mathematics, you can see there's a clear progression, and there's also a clear space for the milk, or in other words, simple and more basic primary, and the meat, which is advanced, which is no less true, but it's more complex.
The only place that you can really go in the church to discuss the meat topics is what you're saying is apologetics, like farm and fairs?
No, apologetics is specifically directed towards addressing specific questions. They're points to theories. The meat is not the answer. The meat, it's apologetics is part of the meat. It is not the meat. It's just a part of it. There are also people who do not have crises of faith that discuss complex things of meat. For example, the Kolob theorem, where the author places God at the center of a specific galaxy with varying concentric circles of a glory.
So, this, Niall, can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
Let's say in a given ward, there was a member of the ward who came across that exact concept. And
which
wanted
one?
The one you just mentioned about this Kolob topic.
Okay.
And they wanted to explore that. And so what they did is they set up and they sent around to the ward distribution list an email and said, hey, on Thursday night over at my house, I am going to have a study group about Kolob and God's influence on the planet Kolob. And it started with two or three people. And it grew to six or seven, and it grew to 15 or 20. The stake president eventually found out about it because his wife was invited. What, in your view, would be the stake president's response to this type of a study group that was starting up in his stake?
I suppose it would be a question of where he falls into the discussion. If, for his own purposes, his access to the evidence and an analysis seems to contradict that, he should enter the discussion and show that.
So you don't believe he would follow the Church Handbook of Instruction, which very clearly discourages any in-home study groups of any church topics?
I'm not aware of any kind of policy like that. I'd have to see the Church Handbook. And
back in the 70s, the church used to encourage those types of things, but then the intellectual process came out. They had the issues that they had, and so all study groups and symposia type areas was discouraged. And now the Sunstone Symposium is discouraged. Many members of the church who used to go and be part of that forum were discouraged and told no longer to attend. And it came directly from church headquarters discouraging open and smaller discussion groups going on just like that.
And yet, the Kolob theorem is openly discussed by faithful members all over the church in many, many different places. It may or may not occur in somebody's house, but it is occurring somewhere. And the point is they're not being censored.
Well, the Kolob theorem, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's being discussed.
I was just using that as an example because you brought that one up.
Right.
That is being discussed in certain other spaces. The space isn't as important. Where the space is not quite as important as that there is a space within the sphere of discourse.
I think one point that should be noted too is that I'm not exactly sure whether the church encourages apologetics. I think it's more of an ambiguous thing that they approach it with.
I disagree. The apologetic thing has been brought directly within the BYU program. It is run out of BYU. And
well, yeah, farms is, yeah.
Thank you for making my point.
I think that, but FAIR is a different entity, than farms. And I know that it's that entity is kind of an ambiguous thing because they're a non-profit organization and I don't know of too many bishops or stake presidents to say, hey, go meet with this FAIR guy or read this FAIR material.
Again, the location of the area isn't as important as the area is provided.
Right. Okay.
But Niall, just to go back to my original question, if there were topics that wanted to be discussed by a member of a stake, say in Ohio or something like that, is there a forum for them to talk about this with other members of the church face to face to talk about more meatier topics?
I couldn't comment on that because I'm not in this situation, but I imagine there would be. There's examples of that all across the internet. The internet is generally a sort of an echo or a reflection of discourses and things that are happening in the real world. there may not be enough Mormons in the area with enough interest in it. You can't really use that as an excuse to call that censorship.
See, my take would be is that they would be actively discouraged to do so and be told that they need to focus on the basics of the gospel and read their Book of Mormon and understand their Book of Mormon and their New Testament and pray and attend the temple.
But
and,
unfortunately, that's sort of left open for speculation and opinion.
No, I think there's many people who have tried it and been told exactly that.
Anecdotal. And there are spaces for them to go do this online and in other places. Maybe not personally face-to-face because there's enough people in Ohio or wherever else they're doing it, but there is a place. Once again, it's not where the space that matters, it's that the space exists. The church is not censoring this.
And George, why is that such a bad thing to keep with the basics, you know, read your scriptures, pray, attend the temple? Why is that such a bad thing? Why is the meat necessary?
Because there are so many things that are not being discussed that are meatful that eventually the milk-only member will run into, and then all of a sudden they're shocked and amazed that something occurred which is more meat-focused, and there's no method for them to find out the real story. There's no bishop-led or stake-led method or forum for them to find. So what they're left to is going to Google and searching and finding all kinds of pro and anti material. The church is not engaged in those conversations officially at all. And so they're left to just kind of waft in the wind. And
yeah. I think the church is trying to get itself out there a little more in Google and YouTube and stuff like that. But I do want to talk a little bit about Sunstone. I think because this topic kind of sort of revolves around why Sunstone even exists, right? Sunstone wouldn't probably exist if we weren't discussing this tonight. But, to George's, point, the reason why I think the church has discouraged Sunstone's symposia in the past is because, well, I don't know, most of Sunstone is run by apostates. George, don't you think that maybe that's part of their intention, the church, from discouraging Sunstone is because they were highly critical and there's run by a lot of apostates?
I believe that's the case. That's the situation, and that they do see that intellectual community is one that questions church leadership more than supports church leadership, and that's why they were that's why the church has generally been discouraged from attending the concepts and ideas that are presented in Sunstone magazines and the symposia definitely are on the fringe of what would be accepted as normal and faith promoting. They're definitely not faith promoting in all cases.
So the church isn't necessarily, maybe depends on what you read, I guess, but I guess the church isn't necessarily discouraging all discussion of doctrine, maybe just discouraging Sunstone, do you think?
I would think that the church would discourage anything, any discussion that is not faith promoting. I recently read a quote from somebody whose parents served a mission calling in the historical department, and what their responsibility was to take missionary journals that were being sent to church offices for archival. And what their responsibility was is to go through these missionary journals and remove anything that was discouraging or totally in the church's favor. So all they did was store just the faith promoting and making the church look in a very positive light. That was their role, and they were it was very clear.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Niall. Would an advanced gospel doctrine class, if the church had a advanced gospel doctrine class, do you think that would help curb some of this discussion?
I suppose if people start going to church for the meat, then yes. I think there's clearly some area of the church where the effectiveness of crossing over from the milk to the meat could be encouraged. But once again, this is true of any organization. And to present this as evidence of censorship, I think, is disingenuous. But yeah, I think an advanced gospel doctrine, perhaps even held on a different day of the week, would be something to really look at.
Do you think there would be a damage that would be done to maybe some of its members? You mentioned that if there were members that were that wanted to go for the meat for these more difficult subjects, do you think that there's a majority of the members that aren't interested in the meat and that that might be part of the reason?
Well, it's the same sort of thing as those who are interested in basic biology versus those who are interested in advanced biology. Those who are bored by it aren't going to go, and those who are interested will. And the ones that are interested will do well.
I think that the struggle I would have is there are some cases in your example of advanced biology versus beginning biology, is there rarely in that type of situation do the two contradict each other. And what I think that the church would run into is there are some situations where milk gospel doctrine would contradict and be corrected by the advanced class.
Well, you can find the same stuff in basic biology and advanced biology. When they first present the ideas to, say, a sixth grader, the simplistic notions, the first survey classes of anything, is going to be apparently contradicted by the advanced classes. You see this time and time again.
But biology, they aren't going, no, that's not true. There's biology is biology, and they will develop on it. They will go into more detail, but they do not teach an advanced class that's going to say, remember the stuff we learned in your beginning class. Well, all that was wrong. Let me tell you how it really works. That does not happen in the scientific world.
Except that it does. You know, you're taught in the basic chemistry class, for example, that a particle can only exist in one state. However, in the advanced, they say, well, actually, that's not true. A particle can exist in more than one state.
All right, let's move out of the science class back into religious class here for a second. Beating this analogy to death. I'm getting lost. What are some of the topics exactly that we're talking about, some of these meat topics? Niall, why don't you tell us some of these topics that you think would be discouraged by the church?
I don't feel the church has any interest in discouraging any of the meat topics.
Do you think the church would be encouraging of an advanced topic on problematic history of the Book of Abraham?
Absolutely. If it has nothing to fear from how the Book of Abraham is presented, it should absolutely encourage that. And I think it does.
In what way?
Well, in the initial phases, it seems like when a criticism is brought up, there seems to be an apologetic response, starting with Hugh Nibley and going from there. But the point is that the conversation is happening. Thus, we have members who believe in a very different sort of form of what the Book of Abraham is without, and let me emphasize this, without being censored. You have somebody saying it's a catalyst. It's a symbol. It's a this. It's a that. And they're not being censored. They're being encouraged. They're going to give callings.
And I would support that type of a move as long as it was being open and honest in what it was telling. But what I worry about, and it goes back to my quotes that I talked about in the very beginning about the mentions of honesty within the Gospel Principles Manual, when it talks very clearly about leaving out areas and leaving out facts, it becomes an issue of honesty. And it is my opinion that in many of these areas, the church chooses to purposely not bring up hard topics in its history in an attempt to keep people at the milk area, because if they brought up the meat topics, there would be very many people who would question the leaders, the past leaders, the current leaders, and I think there would be a greater likelihood that people would leave the organization.
All right, George, but what about all the progress the church has made to correct some of its past history, just like the the ban on the blacks in the priesthood in 1978 when they eliminated that. Obviously opening up the church history library and opening up to the public. I mean, what about all those steps that the church has made to make itself a little more open?
I think they're putting their finger in the dike. They are, there's some of these things that no matter what they do to keep these things down, the society in general is moving around them and making them make a choice. I think several of the changes the church has made that come out as doctrine, that they present as doctrine, are the result of lawsuits. They keep the lawsuit quiet. It makes people feel uncomfortable. They received a lawsuit about this or that. And instead of just coming out and saying, hey, you know what, we had this issue. In order to correct this, we're going to make a change in our policy or in our doctrine. Instead, they say, oh, we just received a revelation that such and such should change. And I think they're responding reactively to some of these areas rather than getting proactively on the ball and coming up with some of these changes on their own.
What would be a satisfactory solution in your mind then, George? Would an advanced gospel doctrine class, if it was held weekly or monthly, would that satisfy you?
It would go an immense way. I think the biggest thing the church has to fight with these days is the fact that the majority of the members do not know some of the hidden issues that are going on. And so when they get surprised by them, they find out about them through some other means, it shakes their faith. And the amount of people in the LDS church today that are having some sort of crisis of faith and either having a major dilemma to go through or just leaving or somehow working their way through it, more and more people are going to have that, and the church is not doing their members any good by hiding behind a shield of revelatory power.
But isn't it true that a lot of people that that go through this crisis of faith were just looking for reasons to sin anyways? That they were just kind of looking for things in the church history?
If you read the end sign, that's what you would learn. If you read the end signs and you listen to conference and anything like that, there are only two reasons why people leave the church. One is that they want to sin. The other one is that somebody has offended them. Totally left out of the conversation from church leadership is those people who research and learn and find meat-type topics that are completely within the teachings of the church, but they find these things out, they've never heard of them before, and they then are shocked, amazed, they can't believe that there's been this deceit wall that's been put up, and they go into what we've adequately described now as a crisis of faith. And if the church encouraged dialogue, if they encouraged debate of some of these doctrines, and they had a way to discuss these topics, I think more people would be accepting of the fact that there is a church that has some flaws and that doesn't have to be exactly right, and the church would come out and say, hey, this happened, this is the way it was, we've made amends, and we've moved on.
What do you think about that, Niall?
Well, I find this distressing. George seems to be fond of bringing up this gap between the milk and the meat, the crisis of faith. And I want to reiterate that this is largely, a bureaucratic thing. The church could put a bridge in there, and they probably eventually will. But especially, I've got to remind George that the onus is on the person. How many people right now are completely clueless about politics, about history, and about science? Why are they like that? Because they're too lazy. They're too wrapped up in their own lives. If a member of the church can't even take the slightest bit of interest in their own eternal salvation, that they want to see the meat, why in the world should I feel sorry for them when they have a crisis of faith? I'm sorry, the onus has to be, at the end of the day, on the faithless member that will absolutely not do their due diligence of seeing the world as it really is, based on the evidence, based on the doctrine, based on opinions of this person, on that person. They may get scared, they may not get scared, but they're going to be richer for the experience. And to blame that on a structure, on a man-guided structure like the church, is absolutely a cop-out.
Let me refute that just a little bit.
All right, hang on a sec. George, hang on a sec. Okay. We need to start wrapping this up, so I'm going to set your conclusion. You can go ahead and respond at the beginning, but you wrap it up in about 5 minutes. So go ahead and respond, and go ahead and do your little conclusion at the end.
So if I am a Republican, and I want to follow, and I want to listen to Republican things, I want to believe that our current presidency is evil and doing very terrible things, I can listen to a 100% Republican message being sent to me. The interesting thing is that the Republican and the GOP leadership does not stop me and does not discourage me from going out and finding information that I can learn that is either neutral, in other words, an independent political opinion, or a Democratic opinion on a topic. There's no discouragement that happens in there at all, and I'm not discouraged or nor reprimanded nor or looked down upon for looking at other points of view and trying to expand my horizons into purely middle of the road and anti. Where what I find in that's disturbing about in the church is, unless it is faith promoting, published by some type of Deseret Book publication and written by a general authority, it's anti. Even if it's a middle of the road, unopinionated, just very neutral look at some element of the church, you're frowned upon, and you could be labeled as an apostate for just reading information that is not published by the church. And that's where I disagree with you in your analysis, is that there is a sense of that in our religious organization. I want to end with a quote by Thomas Edison. It says, "For faith, as well-intentioned as it may be, must be built on facts, not fiction." Faith in fiction is a damnable false hope. What I want to make sure that we understand is that teaching a watered-down version of history is, in a very sense, teaching fiction. We spin it to the benefit of the organization at the expense of the individual. We end up doing deception, lies, and cover-up, which are normally attributed to an evil organization. An organization that preaches one thing but does another is not an organization worthy of loyalty or trust. And I want to just go back and reemphasize from the Gospel Essentials book what is meant by honesty, where it says we can intentionally deceive others by a gesture or a look, by silence, or only by telling part of the truth. Whenever we lead people in any way to believe something that is not true, we are not being honest. And that's what I would close with.
All right. I appreciate that. All right. Niall, give him hell.
All right. I have to echo this idea that it's a terrible thing to have faith in things that are not based in fact. Unfortunately, the straw man that is constantly being created by the critics is that the church discourages doctrine. And, well, I think I've shown time and time again that there are numerous spaces and numerous opportunities to discuss the meatiest of the meat doctrine. And you have to remember that the milk areas are not the meat areas, but the meat areas are there. And if we're talking about whether or not the church discourages or censors or limits discussion of the doctrine, you have to explain away the spaces that exist. The questioning member, the member who encounters a crisis of faith, which is largely through his own negligence, has a place to explore this. And the church does not censor him. He does not excommunicate him. And there was always means by which theology can progress. Remember, there's a sphere of discourse. The evidence are the specific, clearly canonized revelations of God to the prophets. And the doctrine is the extrapolations, oftentimes with error, of man placed upon that. Remember that it's always a discussion. It always progresses. Doctrine can and will become obsolete. And new doctrine can and will be developed. That is all I have to say.
All right. Very nice. All right. Nicely done, both of you.
Wow, we had applause and everything. That's amazing.
I think this was a good discussion. I appreciate both of you guys' input and your preparation. I mean, especially Niall taking us into the science class here and there, but I think it was good. I do hope to see that Niall can attend church now that he's kind of indoctrinated his mind again. He'll be able to attend sacrament meeting on Sunday, and I do hope that George doesn't leave the church after all this. I still hope that he continues to go, but that's just me. Is there any final thoughts you guys want to say?
I am thankful for the prophets.
Niall, thanks for being such a great sport and working with me and sharing your deep love of the gospel there. I know it. This is a challenge being on the same line with a heretic such as myself, and you've really done a great job. So thank you.
Yeah, I think Niall has definitely got a shot at being on the High Council very soon. All right, thanks again, and we'll talk to you later.
Special thanks to Tom, George, and Niall for the Debate Podcast. Remember to check us out on the web at mormonexpression.com. You're also invited to send us an email at mail@mormonexpression.com, or you can call and leave a message at 801-906-6722.
What about you, Niall? I mean, don't you think that a lot of this is just kind of irrelevant, that isn't faith and belief, just kind of an emotional thing between you and God anyways?
Hang on, time out here. What? I can't, I don't think I can answer that in character. Okay, here's what I really think. I think that's a load of crap. You don't get to believe what you want to believe. You believe what exists based on the best evidence you have.
All right, now I got to give you a lot of credit. You've hung through a lot.
So awesome. I'm just very impressed.
I want you all to know, though, that I don't believe a word of what I'm saying.
I know.